Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And we're going to be talking about mind power and a perspective that for a lot of people, not for all people, but for a lot of people, it can be a little bit unsettling. And my guest today is Dr. Mike Denninger, and he's written a book called Snakes in My Dreams. Now, he is a mental health therapist, and so often when it comes to discussing anything that has to do with mental health, people sort of shrivel up and become very frightened. Why? Because it is an area of the unknown. A famous movie called The Snake Pit with a very, very popular actress brought to the public many years ago an awareness that sometimes there can be challenges in people's lives. They don't necessarily have to stay in that mental snake pit, but there is a way that you have to perhaps become aware, understanding the mental illness can affect just about anybody at any time. And I want to welcome to the show Dr. Mike Denninger, because he is a man who has a real insight into this because of the personal journey that he himself has experienced. Dr. Denninger, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's delightful to be here.
Do you mind if I call you Dr. Mike?
Please do. A lot of people do.
Well, I think it just is. You're just such a comfortable person to be around. I really prefer that. Now, you are a man that has quite a unique background, educationally as well as professionally. You're a licensed professional counselor. Now, you deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Correct.
And you also are quite knowledgeable about what something called eye movement integration, which
yes,
we'll go into later on.
Okay.
But you have gotten a BA in English, you got an MS in deaf education, you have taught English at the National Technical Institute for the Deaf at Rochester Institute of Technology. Then you went on to become a coordinator of residence education at a school for the deaf, and you just were highly recognized for American Sign Language, and it's very rare, because usually it's done by people that have hearing, but they have deaf parents. You have been a principal. You have been a dean of a pre-college division. You have done so much. And no one, I would say, if they had the opportunity to chat with you, would imagine the journey that you've traveled. And your memoir, Snakes in My Dreams, had to have been quite an experience to write. How long did it take you to put this book together?
Donna, I think it took me 14 years. I started writing it after I stopped drinking. I was an alcoholic for about 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't sleep, so I just started writing everything I could remember. And over the course of the next 14 years, the journey that you've talked about unfolded and finally ended up as the book, which was published a year and a half ago.
Now, I found it interesting when on the very first page of your prologue, you said it was a presence in a meditation that you had, and you were going through a recovery process with your alcoholism.
Yes.
And you said this presence was there in your meditation. Who was
mm-hmm.
this presence?
Mm-hmm.
You even gave him a name, didn't you?
I did, Sebastian. I was really trying to find myself, and I was very agitated on the surface, so I turned to meditation as a way of calming myself. Of course, I was in therapy as well. But over the next several months to a year, I began to become so comfortable with going inside, if you want to call it that, just listening to my inner self, even asking questions at time, you know, things that I didn't quite understand or things I wanted guidance with. I guess some people would, you know, if you were very religious, you would think of that as prayer. For me, it wasn't connected to an organized religion, but I did come to be aware of a presence that kind of gave me comfort and let me know that I was not alone, and that with the help of the people who were guiding me through my recovery, that I was going to be okay. And the name Sebastian, interestingly enough, came about because I think I probably asked what the name of this entity was, a person or individual. You know, you might think of it as an angel or something like that. But no name came through, but then in the next few days, Sebastian just kept jumping out at me. I went by a church, and it was called Saint Sebastian, and I got a chill in my neck. And I met a young man named Sebastian, and Sebastian came up in a book that I was reading. So I just said, okay, well, let's call it Sebastian and take it from there.
Now, you had a very dysfunctional family. Anymore, I think just about everybody has one. There's very few that don't.
Yes. Mine didn't qualify as the worst, but yes.
You know, I just, as a counselor, and I know you're a counselor too, we can just say, who doesn't have one?
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's just one of those things. And you try to have a sense of humor about it, because the journey of life is going to be difficult at one point or another. But nobody's going to get through this with ice cream and chocolate experiences through their entire life. And your dad, you had a number of members of your family that really, I think, were so lost. They, honest to God, were lost in their own worlds that they were experiencing. And yet, how many siblings did you have? You had a couple of them, didn't you?
I have five, yes.
Yep. So
I have three sisters and two brothers.
Yeah, you've got a good-sized family, and every one of you is so unique, which is typical.
Right.
And did anyone in your family have the challenges other than you that you had, or did you find that your siblings pretty much had experienced a lot of what you had experienced, but they just put it under and, you know, pushed it down inside themselves the way you had?
As far as I know, Donna, I was the only one who was sexually abused in my family. Certainly, all of my siblings experienced the trauma of growing up in an alcoholic household. And I think all of us at some point or another in our lives drank alcoholically. And I'm glad to say, by the way, that all of us are, well, all except one now, are actually not drinking at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a miracle for my family. But yes, they all dealt with it differently. And I think that all of us, however, were wounded in the process.
It's a fascinating patterning, because you say in your book you had a strong genetic predisposition to addiction.
Yes.
And with the alcoholism with your father and so many other members of the family, to be perfectly frank. And you said your preschool sugar cravings foreshadowed future substance dependency. And I think that that is something that causes a lot of concern with many nutritionists when they see the way so many patternings with food have evolved in our everyday environment. You know, this attitude about, because you have a lot of carbohydrates, it converts into sugar, and all this kind of stuff. You really, though, because of your relative then, you, with that experience and with what you went through, and you suppressed that so strongly, you made a statement in your book, vices were rites of passage in our house. Explain that, because Uncle Ben was part of that.
Well, vices were rites of passage because the tendency to smoke cigarettes, for example, was the first. I was the fifth out of six children, And by the time you were, say, 14, it was just almost expected that you would be carrying around a pack of cigarettes with you. When you turned 17, you might be allowed to have a drink at the graduation parties, but certainly by the time you turned 18 and you got the keys to the car, and that was the drinking age in New York at the time, everybody knew that's what you were going to do. You were going to take the car and go out with your friends and go to the bar and drink as much as you wanted to, and just don't throw up or throw anything around when you come home. And so it was like the perfect breeding ground for alcoholism.
Now, with the alcoholism of your dad, because your journey, the snakes in my dreams, your journey that you've put into this book helps, I think, the reader to recognize often the aspect of rage which your father exhibited, especially when he was drinking, is a shadow of the self that when you're not drinking, or in his case, when he wasn't drinking, the shadow couldn't be seen.
Right.
But when he would drink, all inhibitions were gone, and then the rage would take over.
Exactly.
And that's very strongly in PTSD. I mean, this is something that so often people just say, I know, because we had an uncle in my family who served during World War II, and he would just, the rage inside of him, I don't know that it was ever settled.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him almost killing his wife more than once when he
was
asleep.
Mm-hmm.
When he was asleep, and that's what he would do.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it out on his family. And this is what happened with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
But there was more to it than that. And as you were going through your journey as Sebastian, your presence, your muse, was helping you to get through this. How did you handle your rage? Because your father and other members of the family, everything was just buried.
My own rage was similar to my father's. My dad, when he wasn't drinking, was extremely timid. He was so understated that you would think that he was embarrassingly shy. When he drank, like you said, it was the total opposite. In a rage, he would throw chairs, put his fist through the wall, things like that. My rage was very similar. And, you know, when I was drinking, I could become that person, but never to the extent that he was. And thank God that I finally decided to stop drinking. But even to this day, I'm very, very slow to anger. But when the anger does come out, it can come out very forcefully. So it's something that I have to work at all the time.
I think that that is, believe it or not, a very strong part of the human character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being mindful of that component. And I know there are some people that would say, oh, no, 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 no. I've never had that kind of hate or rage. But it's a part, I think, of the survival package of an individual, yet most of us are going to keep a lid on it because we know that that's the appropriate thing to do.
Right.
But to not honor it and to not really look at the fact that we get angry, when you finally awakened to this knowledge that you had been violated by a member of your family, and this is someone that you had even physically taken care of before he died.
Correct.
I mean, this is all this stuff. This rage, how did you work through it? Because that's really the base of your rage, and you think your dad had been abused as well, and that was part of his rage.
Yes, whether he knew it or not, I suspect that probably happened. Well, as I wrote in the book, before I came to feel the rage from my father, I went through a great deal of pain because it got turned inward. So it came out in the form of depression and anxiety, phobias, inability to drive over bridges, to go up in elevators, phobias about being in public and being afraid that I was going to throw up in front of people if I had to give a speech, Those were with me for a good number of years. Now, once I accepted what had happened to me, because I had several memories occur, and the memories came back to me over time. They didn't pop all at once. And I described this very intricately, or I hoped to do that in the book, so that people would understand that not everybody who recalls a traumatic memory just walks outside one day and looks up and says, "Oh my gosh, I was abused." No, it was born out of a great deal of pain over about 18 months' time, depression, anxiety, and physical symptoms that were quite severe. But once I did, and once I accepted the fact, and I'm not sure there was one moment exactly in time, but okay, this happened to me, what do I do? I did do something. It was kind of like a release for me. I wrote a letter to my dead father. He had been dead for, I think, 11 years at that time. And I got on a plane here in Washington and flew up to Rochester, New York, where I grew up, and I went to his grave, and I read the letter with all the rage that, well, it really shocked me, I have to say. I read the letter, and it got very powerful, but then I just, in a flash, fell to my knees and started pounding on his grave and swearing at him like really strong. As I look back at it now, it's almost humorous sometimes, but the force of that still gives me chills when I think about it. I pulverized his grave with my fist and told him to release me and let go and stop bothering me.
Now, one of the components that helped you to face it, because you were having all these dreams.
Yes.
These dreams were coming through, and all kinds of symbology, and you needed to work through it. But you did something a lot of people might not do, and that is that you sought help.
Yeah.
And you then started having dreams that were actually your subconscious regurgitating actual experiences.
Correct.
And when this started happening, this was as if your subconscious said, okay, you're getting to a point where you're going to be willing to accept the truth. And that truth, again, angered you because your father was part of that truth.
That's right. Yes, it was mind-boggling the way that it all happened. But as I said before, I started writing everything I could remember at one point. And then because I was writing everything, I was also recording my dreams. And the closer I got and the more pain I had, the more vivid the dreams became. I think there is one in the book of me being in San Francisco with my mother and my brother, and we're looking uphill, and a tram is coming down, and my dad is there, and he's supposed to get into the tram, and I'm supposed to help him, and I'm all alone in that task. And when the tram arrives, I look down and see that it's actually a coal car, an empty coal car, and when I described this dream to a friend of mine the next day, I just broke out down in tears. I couldn't go on. And it was shortly after that, in a therapy appointment, that I did recall one of the most important times when my father abused me, and it was in the coal bin in the house that we grew up in. And so that's how the dreams and the actual memories were linked.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the eye movement integration. This is something that is gaining more of what I would call acceptance. When you're talking with someone, when they're thinking, neuro-linguistic programming is associated with this, because
yes,
they'll train you in NLP to watch eye movements. If somebody is looking up, they're thinking, and if they go to the left, to the right, something else goes on. How did you find this useful, not only for yourself, but in working with other people?
When I got my counseling degree, and remember, I was 50 years old at the time that I finished my counseling degree. I had been a university administrator for over 20 years. That is when I was going through the recall of my own memories. And so I worked with a therapist who was a hypnotherapist. And I am now also a trained hypnotherapist and trained in as a trainer of NLP and eye movement integration. What's important to understand is that when individuals have post-traumatic stress, it's not just that they're thinking about what happened to them. They're actually having a flashback. They're actually feeling like they're in that moment when they were abused or traumatized or beat up or whatever it was that happened to them. Being in that moment, they feel everything that they felt at that time. They think everything that they thought. So the thought that gets stuck and frozen in them and keeps repeating might be, why is this happening to me? Or something similar to that. In addition to that, they're having physical sensations. They're having heart palpitations. Their palms are sweaty. You know, they've got a knot in their stomach or pressure on their chest. Eye movement therapies, especially eye movement integration, allows the person to, in a very short time, it only takes about 20 to 30 minutes to do this technique, to divorce all of those physical symptoms from the memory. It's almost like a new memory gets created simply by having the person think about that experience, the traumatic experience, and watch the movement of a pen in front of their eyes. I've done this with hundreds of trauma patients, and I do specialize now in trauma and PTSD, and I also train other therapists in how to use it. It's not something that, say, 20 years ago was acceptable in the medical profession, but now these somatic healing techniques, as you might call them, are more and more coming to be accepted as part of the repertoire for dealing with trauma.
Other than yourself, what is the most profound example of using the eye movement integration that you've had?
Oftentimes, other therapists refer patients to me who have PTSD. I will see them for two or three sessions and then send them back to their therapist. One woman was referred to me who had post-traumatic stress from having been battered by her husband repeatedly over the course of a few years and then stalked by her after she got help and got a protection order against her and battered again. She couldn't even think about that experience. So all of her time in therapy after, I think, two or three different therapists was spent avoiding discussing that, and yet she couldn't go out of her house, she couldn't hold a job, she couldn't do anything. So she came to see me, and I knew of her history from talking with her therapist, and she sat down and she kept looking at the floor because that's where her trauma existed in her eye patterns. So the first thing to do was just to get her to look at me. Don't look at the floor, look at me. She said she didn't want to talk about what happened to her. I said, that's fine, you don't have to. What happens to you, though, as a result? And she said, well, for example, when my husband is gone from the house, I crawl under a desk and I sit there and I rock back and forth because I'm terrified. And I said, okay, would you like to work on that part of it, not on the original trauma, just on that? And she said she'd be willing. So we did the eye movement therapy on what I would call a surrogate for her original trauma, you know, something that represented it in her experience on a day-to-day basis. And after we did two rounds of the eye movements, she said, that picture of me is farther away. It's like it happened in the past. I don't feel it so much anymore. She went back home. She came back the next week, and she said she was ready to work on the real trauma. We worked on that. Now, this is only the second session. We worked on the real trauma, and she was able to let it go. She was able to think about it without really going into a panic attack. Now, the interesting thing, Donna, though, is she came back to me for another session before I sent her back, and she said she was mad at me. And I said, well, why are you mad at me? She said, because you interrupted my plan. Before she came for the second session, she had a plan to kill herself.
Mm-hmm.
She had it all mapped out. She knew where she was going to go, how she was going to do it. And I interrupted her plan.
Mm-hmm.
I interfered with it because she started to have doubts about it.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. And she said she had no plan then, she went back to her therapist, and she's really doing quite well. I heard back from her therapist about 6 months later and said she was a different person, and she's out there and doing what anybody would do in living their life.
Mm-hmm. Taking her life back.
Yes.
Taking her dominion back in her
exactly.
life. Which is what you did with yours. For all of this, what do I want to say, regurgitating of
yes.
the past. And I think that's something that many times we are not aware that creates our blocks in life.
Yes.
And when we can finally get to that,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes we just have to own up to it, which was part, you were seeking therapists, but you also had to do the work.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, there's yes. no way that somebody's just going to be able to give you a pill and it's going to go away. No, because we have to have integrity with ourselves.
Yes.
And I think that that is one of the biggest accomplishments of anyone. And you also went through a major evolution, and that's where your book, Snakes in My Dreams, you just is so well stated how spiritually, emotionally, physically, mentally, even though you were so well-educated, there was a whole new you that had the opportunity to be born. Where
yeah.
you could utilize your past to help others. And you feel that's one of the phenomenal gifts that was given to you for all of the unpleasant, ugly stuff that you've gone through and you've worked through. And I'll quote from your book, you found meaning and experienced exhilaration in helping individuals recover the way others once helped you. And you said that's what you do when you find an answer. You pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I couldn't agree with you more. I do.
Oh, thank
oh,
you.
Oh, boy.
Thank
that
you.
Is
yes.
so important.
Yes, that was important. And it came to be actually what I believed was my purpose, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to celebrate that some terrible things happen to you, but you can also use it in a way that makes sense to you and also makes you not just authentic, but helpful and productive, and it gives its return to you as well.
Now, Dr. Mike, people can go to your website, Denninger.com, and that's spelled D like David, E N like Nelly, N like Nelly, I N like Nelly, GER.com.
There's just one N in there, Donna.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I misspelled it. It's DENINGER. Thank
that's
you
right.
for correcting me. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that your description of, mental illness per se, I have yet to meet anyone that hasn't experienced it in some way or another. It doesn't mean that you have to be a Looney Tune in a straitjacket in some mental hospital. Illness of the mind can come about because of pain, suffering, being abused like you were, being really in need of just having a chance to have a voice, to be able to let things come out. And I think of the old movie that I mentioned, The Snake Pit, and I think Olivia de Havilland was
there. Yes, that's right.
And when I happened to see it a few years back, I had never seen it. And when I saw it, it was a demonstration. In our world today, I don't even know when it was made. If it was made in the 30s or 40s, I have no idea.
It was
but
a long time ago.
It was. And yet the humaneness of that movie, of that story, was about a woman who went through excruciating emotional angst And she ended up being put in an institution. And yet she didn't really belong there, but she had to find herself.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us will go through something like that on one level or another. Most of us will not be put in an institution. Well, maybe somebody may suggest it's a good idea. But, yeah.
Have you had that happen, too?
Oh, yes. And so, you know, there's just so much in life. And I think that's where when we can find those people like you did, therapists, people that are sincere, they really care. Usually they've gone through that walk somewhere in their life, their experience. And I think that's the gift, one of the many gifts that your book, Snakes in My Dream, The Mental Health Therapist Odyssey from Hardship to Healer. And, of course, I'm assuming that's your picture on the front.
That is my graduation from kindergarten.
Mm-hmm. Graduation from kindergarten. Life has all kinds of experiences, and sadly, sometimes they can be pretty painful. But you are a man that really cares, and you walk your walk and talk your talk, but you can back it up, like I said, because of the walk that you've walked. And it's wonderful to know that people like you are there. So for those of you that would like to explore more, especially about eye movement integration and some other things that Dr. Mike is involved with, check out his website, Deninger, Deninger.com. Dr. Mike, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I hope you are enjoying your summer months, whatever you are doing, and telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to give me a buzz, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into for those of you that might be first-time listeners. All I need is your first name or initial. Let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that may be of a concern to you. Again, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about true angel stories. Diane Cooper, who is in England, is going to be my guest. And this is a woman, if you can imagine, she has collected over 700 stories. So we obviously won't be able to talk about but just a few. And then also we are going to be talking with Catherine Woodfield. Don't buy that health insurance. Now, I know so many of you are going through wondering, what are you going to do with health insurance? I was talking with someone just a few days ago. She pays over $1,000 a month for the family of four. That's over $12,000 a year for health insurance. She's a woman that is in her 30s. She has young children. and obviously a husband there too with the four of them, and it is that expensive for them. So this is something we're going to be discussing at length. Now, we're also going to be talking about Athesina's medicine this week. We're going to be stepping back in history and finding out about medicine that we're utilizing the basics of today. And this was recorded 1,000 years ago. So we're going to be stepping back in history with that. And then this week we'll be talking with Marvin Brown, how to meet and talk to anyone, any place, anywhere. You feel shy? Do you have a difficult time stepping up to a stranger and just beginning some chit-chat? Well, maybe you're at a party. You don't know exactly what to do. Well, Marvin is going to share with us some tips and more than that. Show us how we can be comfortable with people no matter where we are. And that is something that I think is a valuable tool, because so many times we'll freeze up in environments that we're not, well, let's say, comfortable with, like a party or an environment of meetings that maybe we've not experienced before, a convention, things like this. So it's going to be, I think, a dynamic week, so be sure you tell your friends about these upcoming guests that we've got. What would you do if you were a multimillionaire, you loved the sense of adventure, and you perhaps were told that you were not going to live? What do you think you would do? Well, I'm going to share with you a story about a gentleman. His name is Forrest Fenn, and he lives in New Mexico. This is a man so wealthy he'd never have to worry about money as long as he lives. However, what occurred to him is that in 1988, he was diagnosed with terminal kidney cancer. Well, this is a man that's always loved adventure. From the time he was a kid, he and his brother would, on summer vacations, explore all kinds of places like Yellowstone National Park. And he just always had this love of adventure. In fact, he was a pilot during the Vietnam War with the Air Force. Now, when he finished his military stint after Vietnam, he decided he was going to settle in New Mexico, and he became an arts and antiques dealer. And that was just his passion. He loved it and was very, very successful with it. Well, when he was given this verdict that his life was not going to be going on for much longer because of the kidney cancer, he said he wanted to create something that was exciting. He wanted something that was going to create hope. He said, after all, I was told I was terminal. So he decided that he wanted to create an adventure. Now, currently, he's 82 years old. So obviously, he didn't die as they thought he was going to die. But he said he had something else, too. He wanted to get kids out of a game room and off the couch. So this is what he did. He devised a treasure hunt. Now, he had a small bronze chest. He had had this for a long time, and he decided he was going to put items in this chest. He began putting in gold coins and gold nuggets, the real thing, not make-believe, the real thing. Now, his cancer ended up going into remission in 1993. And he's still around today. He decided he was going to keep the game going anyway, even though he wasn't going to be dying as soon as they had predicted. Now, in 2010, this is what he did. He filled the chest with jewels and valuable stones and then hid it in the Rocky Mountains north of where he lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he wrote a poem for his self-published memoir, The Thrill of the Chase. And in that poem, it contains 9 clues about the box's whereabouts. Now, he took a picture of this box, and it's beautiful. It's just ornate as it can be. And it's filled with all of this gold and gold coins, gold nuggets, precious stones, jewelry, bracelets. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. This is for real. It's real stuff in here. Now, one of the stanzas in his poem reads as follows. Begin it where warm waters halt and take it in the canyon down. Not far, but too far to walk. Put in below the home of Brown. Now, the story, his story, about this treasure that he planted in the Rocky Mountains appeared in a magazine, and he has received thousands of emails from treasure hunters, and many want more than just the clues that are in the poem, but most of the time, he's gotten emails from people thanking him for bringing their family together. Now, this past April, he did an appearance at an Albuquerque bookstore, and he said that there were two groups of treasure hunters that had gotten within 500 feet of the chest. He knows it, but maybe they don't know it, because he said they walked right by it. They did not know that they were that close to the treasure. Now, he said one day it's going to be found, and he said it's going to take the right combination of cunning and perseverance. And he said it'll be discovered by someone who's read the clues successfully. No one's just going to accidentally find it. And he says he hopes that whoever finds this treasure is going to really enjoy the adventure that they've had, treasure hunting. It's wonderful. Did you ever do a treasure hunt when you were a kid where different people's houses, you were given a map and you had to go to different places? There was a game, a treasure hunt, and I can remember doing that when I was younger, and it's a lot of fun. But there are those people that really live for the discovery of a treasure. That's what brought about the discovery of the Titanic. It's brought about the discovery of so many ships, booties of different types that have been found that people never, ever thought could be discovered. Part of that, too, has evolved because of technology. We're now able to sensor things, S-E-N-S-O-R, sensor things and find out if something's metal, if it's not, where something could be, depth in waters, all kinds of things. It's absolutely amazing what we are able to do today because of technology. And speaking of technology, you can chat with me if you like, 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call into if you would like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I want to give you a little bit of trivia. The harmonica. Now, you don't hear too much about harmonicas anymore, but believe it or not, the instrument is alive and well, and there are many, many people that play it. Do you know where it was invented? When? Well, I think the precursor to the harmonica was the flute. And you have all kinds of flutes. You may be thinking of the more formal version of the flute, but if you think of Pan's flute that he played, it was filled with different reeds of different lengths so that you get different tones. There's a wonderful musician called Zanthier that he will play those pipes and create sounds that are just absolutely amazing. So this is something that evolved over a period of time. Well, it was invented in Germany in the 19th century, and then Americans really liked the concept, and they reinvented it in the 20th. Now, Europeans had played with their version of the harmonica, and they would do it only by exhaling, and they liked their waltzes and marches. Now, the African-American musicians learned how to blend notes by drawing air into the instrument, making it superb for a new musical form. And what was that form? The blues. That's right. There are so many marvelous musicians that utilize the harmonica, and it is absolutely amazing. It's got sounds inside that, when they're played correctly, that are haunting harmonicas. Just a little bit of trivia. This is Donna Sebo. When we come back, more good things to share, and I'd be delighted to share my intuitive gifts with you. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number is 888-627-6008. I don't know about the rest of you, but I have been out with blackberries. Yes, here in the Pacific Northwest, they are in their prime. We have blackberry bushes not too far from where we live. And so I have been out picking, and I've put up a gallon and a half of blackberries. They just absolutely make the best preserves, especially if you can't keep them. And fresh berries, you can't keep for very long. So when you do pick them, you want to make sure you put them in the refrigerator right away, and then don't wash them until just before you're ready to use them. But they have just been incredible this year. We've had such a good level of rain, and then with all of the sunshine that we've been experiencing, they're just really great. A suggestion I make, if you're going to do any canning, don't be afraid to try something different. And with the blackberries, I've added cinnamon, and I have just had fun by putting in almonds and doing different things like that. Don't be afraid to explore and experiment if you're going to do any canning, but allow that it's going to take some time and have patience. But, ooh, during the winter months, you're going to be able to enjoy those special goodies that you have taken the time to put together. And also, they make good gifts for friends at the holidays, too. Would you stick your foot in a box with a tarantula? I don't think I'd be likely to do that. Oh, by the way, did you know there's such a thing as pink tarantulas? There really are. I've seen them. I know. Well, this is something that British researchers ask 20 volunteers to do. They ask them to lay down in an MRI machine and to put their feet in a box that had several compartments and watch the screen that showed a tremendous tarantula crawling among the sections. Would you volunteer for something like this? I don't think I would. No. Scientists watched this. Now, why were they doing this? They wanted to see what happened in the brain. And, of course, they're wired for this. They've got all kinds of sensors on these people's heads. And they said the volunteers' brains, they would light up depending on whether the spider moved towards or away from his or her feet. The kicker of this whole thing was, is that there actually was no spider. They watched a pre-taped video. The volunteers did not know that this was not really happening to them. Now, what happened because of this? Well, they learned how the brain responds to changing threats, and it said it could help doctors treat phobias, and this is what they were looking at. And I thought, well, if someone was astute observer, and they were watching their own feet, you know, on the screen, they'd know that those weren't their feet. But maybe the focus was more on the tarantula, and so they didn't pay attention. And then the responses, mentally, were recorded. Also, there was a woman in November of 2010, this was done in Germany, where she opted to give birth in an MRI machine. Now, this is something that typically isn't recommended because of the high amount of radiation that this is, but they call it a super cool scan because it reveals for the first time what childbirth looks like from the inside as the baby is moving down the birth canal. You can even see how the head changes shape as the final process of birth, as the mother's pushing and those muscles are forcing the child out. They said this will enable to see, for a doctor to see, how birth sometimes will just stop. The baby is not moving. It gets jammed in the birth canal. And also how other complications can result. It's amazing what they are able to do today. So that's just a little bit of trivia that I wanted to share with you. Again, people do all kinds of things so that we can learn more about what we'd like to know. It's an ongoing thing. We never learn ever everything. It's just not possible. And again, because of technology, we're doing a lot of this. And remember, all of these people were volunteers. No one was forced to do it. I've got a picture in front of me of a man who is holding a python that's 11 feet, 1 inch in length. Now, this guy's pretty tall. This snake is sort of folded in half. And when I say that, I mean, he's got his two arms reaching up, and he's just holding as much of the snake up so that it's barely touching the ground. This is amazing. But what's even more amazing is that this 11-foot python, which is not a venomous snake, was found in Florida. They're really having some major problems with people who have dumped their snakes. And they're just thriving in the environment. It's warm weather. They've got plenty of food. And they just grow to these humongous lengths. Pythons can get to be up to 30 feet. There was one that was discovered, I forget where it was. It was in Indonesia or someplace like that. Huge, huge snake. Well, this guy won $1,000 for catching the biggest or the longest python that has ever been caught. And they really have taken to making Florida their home. Well, it's affecting a lot of the other animal species in the Florida environment, and they just don't know how to work with this ecosystem. So what they have formed, they actually are doing what the Aussies do with the wallabies. They are having hunts for snakes because pythons can lay up to 100 eggs, and consequently, that's a lot of snakes going out. So they are harvesting them. That's exactly what they're doing in Florida. But it is quite a challenge because for all of these snakes that now are there that weren't there before, they can't find them all that easily. That's right. They got plenty of places to hide. So the big snake business, well, in Florida, as of 2010, it's outlawed Burmese pythons and several other giant snake species as pets. And they've imposed a federal ban on their importation or interstate transfer. Well, that is not unusual. We have snakes here in the Pacific Northwest, in the western section. In the eastern section, they have of the Pacific Northwest in Washington, the state of Washington. They have rattlesnakes, but that's hot weather over there. It goes extreme from hot to very, very cold. But here on the western side, there's not many, but every once in a while you'll see a little garter snake or something like that. The environment just isn't conducive. They don't like it here. It's too wet, which is fine with me. This is Donna Siebel. I know that we're just about out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And don't forget to join me tomorrow for Angel Stories with Diane Cooper. And again, we'll be traveling to England to chat with her. Have a wonderful day. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy being you. This is Donna Siebel. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.